Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The cow goes moving. Hi, welcome to Bookworm on KCRW. This afternoon we have an unusual show. It's more of a quest or saga story than the usual interview program, but it will include poems by James Merrill, sections from a novel by Georges Perec, and a fascinating interview with the puzzle maker from Vermont, Steve Richardson of Stave Puzzles. In fact, my subject is literature and puzzles. It's one that's fascinated me probably all my life, from the very first day my mother bought me my first copy of Alice in Wonderland. When I was a student at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and like most students, always moving, one day I was moving the things of my friend Marilyn. She had many boxes and trunks. We loaded them into a truck, and I found among her possessions one rattling, noisy black box, and I asked Marilyn what was in it. She said, "Oh, that's just the jigsaw puzzle. My grandmother gave it to me. I inherited it from her." I said, "A jigsaw puzzle, but there's no picture on the box." I opened the box. There, carved, hand-carved out of wood, was the most beautiful puzzle, all in pieces, that I'd ever seen. Even the pieces were special. These wooden pieces were shaped like objects. A piece would be shaped like a rabbit or a cat, or a silhouette of President Lincoln, letters of the alphabet, stars, numbers, moons. Now, I had known that in America there had been a rage for jigsaw puzzling, and I'd never really understood it because it seemed that the art of jigsaw puzzling was boring. How often can you enjoy sitting and fitting one meaningless piece next to another? But these puzzles, puzzles in which you discover that as you were putting together the figure of Julius Caesar, there would be a rat or rabbit in his cape, pieces shaped in all sorts of curlicues, so that as the picture grew, you were making the puzzle world out of constituent parts that were amazing. I became fascinated. I learned that these puzzles were rented in around 1910 to 1930, from bookstores. You could rent them by the week. They were really extraordinarily beautiful things, and one couldn't find them now in the age of cardboard, machine-cut jigsaws. What were you going to do? Well, a little bit later, in 1972, I found a poem printed in the New Yorker, a poem by James Merrill called Lost in Translation. It was a beautiful poem, and it talked about the very kind of puzzle I'd put together. It appeared in his book in 1976 called Divine Comedies, and it's a poem about how a boy sits putting together a sumptuous jigsaw puzzle while his family is falling apart. His parents are planning a divorce. We're going to hear sections of that poem now, the sections that involve the puzzle.
The poem is called Lost in Translation. A card table in the library stands ready to receive the puzzle which keeps never coming. Daylight shines in, or lamplight down, upon the tense oasis of green felt. Full of unfulfillment, life goes on. Mirage arisen from time's trickling sands, or fallen piecemeal into place. German lesson, picnic, seesaw, walk with the collie who did everything but talk. Sour windfalls of the orchard back of us. A summer without parents is the puzzle, or should be. But the boy, day after day, writes in his line a day, no puzzle. Out of the blue, as promised, of a New York puzzle rental shop, the puzzle comes. A superior one containing 1,000 hand-sawn, sandal-scented pieces. Many take shapes known already, the craftsman's repertoire nice in its limitation, from other puzzles. Witch on broomstick, ostrich, hourglass, even, surely not just in retrospect, an inchling innocently branching palm. These can be put aside, made stories of, while Mademoiselle spreads out the rest face up, herself excited as a child, or questioned like incoherent faces in a crowd, each with its scrap of highly colored evidence the law must piece together. Sky blue ostrich? Likely story. Mauve of the witch's cloak, white severed fingers pluck? Detain her. The plot thickens as all at once two pieces interlock. Mademoiselle does borders. Straight-edge pieces align themselves with earth or sky in twos and threes, naive cosmogonists whose views clash. Nomad inlanders, meanwhile, begin to cluster where the totem of a certain vibrant egg yolk yellow or pelt of what emerging animal acts on the straggler like a trumpet call to form a more sophisticated unit. By supper time, two ragged wooden clouds have formed. In one a shake with beard and flashing sword hilt, he is all but finished, steps forward on a tiger skin. A piece snaps shut, and fangs gnash out at us.
That was James Merrill, and he's reading from his poem, Lost in Translation, published in 1976 by Athenaeum. The poem fascinated me in that it alluded precisely to an experience I had had. I began to collect samples of puzzles in literature, the famous chess game that makes Alice Through the Looking Glass a double work, one that you can read and work out on a chessboard simultaneously. At that school, the State University of New York at Buffalo, the bigwig writer in residence was John Barth, and so I became interested in the kind of novel Barth writes, a novel like a gigantic puzzle, a construction, really. And I began to see all sorts of puzzles in language everywhere. Lewis Carroll once mentions that he was walking around London and he came upon a great big sign. It said, he said, romancement. He went back home, he was thrilled, a sign saying romancement in the middle of London, and brought others to look at it. Well, when they get there, it turns out that the sign said Roman cement. These kinds of things fascinated me. I learned that if you took the letters in the word incomprehensible and scrambled them, you'd come up with problem in Chinese. Useless things, too, like the fact that the letters in the word maraschino could be rearranged to spell harmonicas. In fact, I grew fascinated in puzzles that Stephen Sondheim was doing for the New York magazine, and I began to see in some of his lyrics an interest in some play with language that had nothing to do with the content of the song. And so, in a song of his, he talks about love having its effect on people and says, some are hasty, some are halting, some are simply somersaulting. And the play is a special gift that the lyric offers. And again, you find these special added things that reminded me of my experience of this puzzle, of having a picture that fell apart into beautiful component curlicued pieces. At last, I learned something about the Oulipo, that mysterious school of French writers. Oulipo stands for Ouvrage de la Littérature Potentielle, which means the workshop for potential literatures. And these Oulipo writers made books according to certain hidden schemes and included language games and rebuses, all sorts of tricks in their novels. Among the Ulipo writers were Italo Calvino, whose wonderful Cosmic Comics was at that time really enchanting me. There was Raymond Queneau, a great and funny, a hilarious French novelist. And finally, one named Georges Perec, who didn't seem to be in translation. Well, last year, a book by Perec was published in translation by David Godine, the publisher in Boston. It's a beautiful book. It's called Life, a User's Manual. And there, once again, I found the presence of my old friend, the jigsaw puzzle, which I've been searching for all the time. The week I'd spent putting together that puzzle had been one of the most happy in my life. I'd looked everywhere for another one. Marilyn wouldn't sell me hers. It was her gift from her dead grandmother. But I found another reference to the puzzle in Life, User's Manual. He talks about the pleasure of doing puzzles, and especially what a good puzzle maker is. I quote from Life, a User's Manual by Georges Perec. The role of the puzzle maker is hard to define. In most cases, and in particular in all cardboard jigsaws, the puzzles are machine-made, and the lines of cutting are entirely arbitrary. A blanking die, set up once and for all, cuts the sheets of cardboard along identical lines every time. But such jigsaws are avoided by the true puzzle lover, not just because they are made of cardboard instead of wood, not because the solutions are printed on the boxes they come in, but because this type of cut destroys the specific nature of jigsaw puzzles. Contrary to a widely and firmly held belief, it does not really matter whether the initial image is easy or difficult. It's not the subject of the picture or the painter's technique which makes a puzzle more or less difficult, but the greater and lesser subtlety of the way it has been cut. The art of jigsaw puzzling begins with wooden puzzles cut by hand, whose maker undertakes to ask himself all the questions the player will have to solve, and instead of allowing chance to cover his tracks, he aims to replace chance with cunning, trickery, and subterfuge. Every move the puzzler makes, the puzzle maker has made before. Every piece the puzzler picks up and picks up again and studies and strokes, every combination the puzzler tries and tries a second time, every blunder and every insight, each hope and each discouragement have all been designed, calculated, and decided by the puzzle maker. Well, there it was, the puzzle that I'd wanted to find. I read this section of the book, Life, a User's Manual, to my friend, the wonderful writer Mitchell Siskind. And within, I'd say, 3 weeks' time, Mitchell had found in the New Yorker a tiny, tiny ad for a puzzle company in Norwich, Vermont, called Stave Puzzles, that hand-cut its jigsaws out of wood and personalized them. Mitchell wrote away for a catalog. He brought it to me, and there it was, all there, everything that I hoped for. I looked through the catalog and saw puzzles with extraordinary pieces. One among them, I saw a jigsaw puzzle on the theme of A Midsummer Night's Dream, with pieces in the shape of little wood sprites and fairies wielding wands, and all sorts of others. There were puzzles with pieces shaped like knights in armor, little devils, winged cupids with bow and arrows, a puzzle designed for newlyweds with a picture of a man carrying his newlywed wife over the threshold, the bed. All of these are just pieces of the puzzle having nothing to do with the picture. When I began this show, I decided I must investigate the relationship
of literature and poetry to these puzzles because they seem so much the same. And I contacted Stephen Richardson of Stave Puzzles in Norwalk, Vermont, and I started to talk to him, asking him, would he do me the favor, the service, the honor of letting me, after 12 years of searching, try one of his puzzles. I wasn't sure the puzzle would be the thing I wanted, but when it arrived at my house, it is exactly what I've dreamt of. I open it up and begin the solving of a puzzle and what I hope will be a long-standing friendship with Steve Richardson of Stave Puzzles in Norwalk, Vermont. I believe I have him on the phone now. Steve, are you there?
I'm here. We're here in nice, sunny, warm, I mean about 20 degrees, Michael, in Norwich. Yes, we are. Michael's on the other line.
Oh, great. There is a mystery guest for the end of this show. You now know his name, like mine is Michael. Steve, how did you get involved with puzzle making?
When I was a child, my grandparents had wooden puzzles out on their card table every time I went to visit. And I became hooked doing their puzzles, and then we would visit some inns in New Hampshire skiing. They would have wooden puzzles out on their tables. So in my youth, I was exposed to them. About 20 years ago, I dropped out of the corporate life and was attempting to find another occupation that I could make a living at up here in Norwich. And I started a game design company, and we made games out of and jigsaw puzzles. These are cardboard out of New York Times crossword puzzles. And from there, our interest in jigsaw puzzles went to Vermont Scenes, and we worked with the Vermont Life magazine making jigsaw puzzles for them that they could sell to their customers. I was contacted by a Boston gentleman back in 1974 who was looking for someone to make him a wooden jigsaw puzzle for his wife. He had been buying puzzles from a New York company called Par Puzzles that made exquisite wooden puzzles, and they had gone out of business. He saw we made the cardboard puzzles. We wanted to know if he wanted to know if we could make a wooden one for him. He offered to pay us $300 for that one puzzle, and at that time we were getting $3 a puzzle for our cardboard ones. Needless to say, some lights went off in my head, and I explored the market. And that summer, I decided to teach myself how to make a wooden jigsaw puzzles. And I sat in my garage with a jigsaw and cut out what felt like a zillion pieces to try to figure out what was going on. And I must tell you that it was extraordinarily difficult to make these intricate pieces in the shapes of horses and cows and people and whatever. I advertised in New Yorker magazine, the very place where your friend saw the ad, and the response was fantastic because there was a following of this New York company that was hungry for more wooden puzzles. And from 1974, we've grown by about an employee a year, and we now have there are 14 of us here in Norwich now that work together to craft puzzles for people from all over the world.
When I think about Stave Puzzles in Norwich, Vermont, I think it's like Santa's workshop with elves scurrying all over and chuckling maliciously about the great tricks that are going to await the puzzle solver. Do you all cackle up there?
Do we all what, Michael? I'm sorry.
Cackle.
Cow, you bet we do. You should have heard us today when customers are calling in trying to solve the rebuses which we craft into the puzzles. They were having such a terrible time. It turns out one gentleman that was trying to solve it upside down, and that's why he was giving us such screwy answers, but we were just cackling away, regaling at the difficulty they were having with that particular puzzle and with other people having difficulty too. I must say there's a certain sadomasochistic bond here we have with the customer that we all delight from. The customer, even though they have great difficulty with the puzzle really do enjoy the difficulty, and we take great pleasure in it.
You were mentioning to me on the phone some weeks ago that you thought that there was a left-brain, right-brain connection between the visual art of puzzling and the literary art of poetry.
Yes, I think most of us know that the experts attribute the left brain to where we deal with words, and the right brain to where we deal with images. In fact, I've found that many of our customers are writers, editors, lawyers, and they spend so much time word processing, dealing with contracts, they need a relief. And the relief is puzzles, as far as, you know, getting more of their right brain out of the closet and getting more exercise, and I find it's a great escape.
You know, it was wild because when I started to solve one of Stave's puzzles, I discovered within it that there were straight edges within the picture so that you couldn't do the usual layout, the border kind of thing. There were even fake corners that belonged inside the picture, not at the corner. These kinds of things make picture puzzling devilish, and as Steve mentioned, there are also rebuses. A rebus is a word puzzle. You might see the letter M followed by a bottle of ink, mink, and then a piece shaped like a goat, mink goat, mink coat. And you would solve these internal puzzles and return to the Stave people to have them say, "You got it right, good boy." It came as a particular delight to me when I was noodling around. "Do you find these puzzles poetic?" I asked Steve. "Well," he did, "yes. Have you any interest in poetry?" I read him some of the quotes I'd gathered up, and he didn't know them. He was thrilled, thought he might put them in his catalogs. But not in particular. And then he ventured that there was someone in his family who was interested in poetry. And who was that, Steve?
That's my son, Michael. Who was a student at Wesleyan University down in Connecticut. For a long time, he has shown a very artistic inclination for painting and for writing and for particularly writing poems.
You know, it's so interesting because then I spoke to Michael. He's 20 years old, and reminded me so much of what my life felt like at that age. At that time, I was also leaving college, going off to travel in Europe to my parents' dismay, and here was someone I was talking to on the phone who's reading with excitement Robert Bly and John Ashbery, doing all the things that a young poet does. Michael, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, good. So here's your alter ego, another Michael, me here, the bookworm. Tell me, when did your interest in poetry start, and did it start in some way with your father's puzzles?
Well, perhaps unconsciously it did. I can imagine that would be the case. I started reading John Ashbery quite a long time ago, and that's some of the most puzzling poetry I've ever read. I still have yet to really understand one of his poems.
You never will.
No, I don't know. But actually, I've only started intense reading and writing just this past year. Although I've always had, I'm sure, on the back burner of my mind somewhere, some sort of interest in it.
Tell me, when you decided to leave school this year, did you have any idea that it was something that a poet tends to do at that time in his life?
Oh, I don't know. I guess, yeah, that makes sense. Given how poetry is a priority in my life and how school is not, doesn't compare to what I would consider poetry in my life as far as devoting my time to it. Yeah.
It kind of relieved me to discover you out there because, you know, among the hordes of MBAs I meet who are in college here in Los Angeles and who've never dreamed of anything but their new car, I was delighted to find that you take an interest in the ecology of the planet. We've been talking about ecology and sending each other books and notes and things, and one of the things that Michael sent me was a little essay he wrote on poems and puzzles. uniting his interest and my interest with his father's interest. And I wondered if you might read us a bit of that essay. What is it called, Michael?
It's called Poeslam.
That's the portmanteau word, as Lewis Carroll called them, between poem and puzzle. And let's hear what you've got.
Okay, thank you, Michael. First, let's talk about puzzles. Let's even say you've never put one together, or even seen a completed one. You might do anything with the scraps. You could try eating them, or if you're young, or piling them precariously. You'd have to have some notion of what the intention of the maker was, that it isn't supposed to be so easy as swallowing. At first, it seems you'd be completely in the dark. However, simple passive perception might shed some light. Given a little contemplative observation, the pieces could be ordered in ways even before fitting any of them. I think it'd be instinctual, even if one were completely ignorant, to turn all the pieces either unanimously up or down. And it'd all look a lot more interesting up. Any playful spirit would lead you to start gathering types, classifying. One might think of the pieces as people. The reds want to be with the reds, the yellows with the yellows, and of course the mauves with the mauves. That can be altered. Now it seems that one group has all lines in it, leaving some pieces without a group to belong to. Listen carefully, and tiny, strange vocal sounds start to pop up from the groups, each sounding a flavor peculiarly appropriate to its appearance. You see just one connection, symmetrical space between, sensible emptiness. Alas, two pieces side by side the whole time, with ins just as the others out. Slowly, smiling, the hand lifts one piece up and gently, effortlessly slides it down to interlock with the other, like the knuckles of two intergripped hands. There is no time to gawk or even to test the strength. Your eyes start blaring, blasting the shapes and colors with blazing perception. And another. What a revelation that an image is coming together, of some ancient or far-off place, or of some tiny thing painted in detail. That image was there the whole time, like a ghost hiding in a pile of bricks. Finally, the last piece is put in. It didn't seem to take any time at all. Ah, it's a landscape with houses and fields and animals and people smiling as they do their work. Again, let's play an ignorant person. Let's say you've never seen a flying creature in all of your life, and as you stroll through the woods one day, you chance upon a pile of feathers and bones, in fact, all the parts of a once-living creature. You're curious enough to want to piece it together, for obviously it was once whole. But unless you've got some sort of notion of aerodynamics or a strong urge to fly, it'd be nearly impossible to reassemble the thing, let alone know it once flew with stunning grace. Such is the situation with a lot of people in poetry. They toy with the images, look at the heap of words, and shrug, saying, "Is this it?" Given the mirroring nature of these two art forms, poetry and puzzling, just as many people might be missing the poetic quality of puzzles, how the emerging out of chaos of something sensible and beautiful has real, profound relevance to life.
Well, we've been talking to Steve Richardson and Michael Richardson, father, master puzzler, son, puzzle maker in Norwich, Vermont. It's been a pleasure to have them on the show. I salute both of them. I know that in a certain way, for them, saying rest in peace means to say rest in pieces. I hope that they will be back soon, and it's good afternoon from your bookworm, Michael Silverblatt.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now the book of the mouse pop time.
You're listening to KCRW Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California.